Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. You all look great this morning. You just look bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, ready to... I'm not talking to the panel. I'm talking about to the listeners.
Oh, okay.
But the panel, equal in bright-eyed and bushy-tailedness. Good morning, all. Welcome to the program. I hope you had a lovely, lovely day yesterday. Beautiful weather. And hopefully you'll have a good day today and an even more gorgeous weekend and can celebrate it in all the ways appropriate for the dwindling days of summer. Let's just put it that way. The dwindling days of what we consider to be the summer season. Last night, I went with a friend to the Washington County Fair. We've been to the Washington County Fair every night this week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Wow.
We'll be there tonight. And have you been there, Aaron, yet? Have you gone?
I have not been there this year, but I've gone in the past.
Yes. So I just here's what I struck me is that you roam from one end of the fair to the other, and we're not big. We don't go on the rides or anything. We just spend a lot of time with cows and goats and sheep and the like. And learn how to build a screech owl house, things like that. And but I was running the gauntlet between running around kids and strollers and poop and all that stuff and came out completely unscathed with the rocks and the dirt and the dust. And I came home, I was putting my dog away, and I stepped on a squeaky pig.
Mm-hmm.
And I went for a ride, and I just really, yeah. And then my ankle got about as big as a canned ham. And so I'm thinking, how do I, like, first of all, the first thing that came to me is that, well, I hope this doesn't have any effect on my fair-going activity tonight. And then I thought, but the most disturbing thing about it was it's happening, right? But there's just this longest squeak you've ever heard. It just sounds wrong as all of my weight is going on to this toy that is propelling me through the dining room.
I'm glad you can laugh about it.
No, it's fine. Yeah. It's fine. You know, it's
put your foot up. I'll get you some ice.
The pleasures the pleasures of dog ownership, but he's got a lot of toys. We got to work on.
I mean, it's better than stepping on a real pig at the fair.
Well, that's
right?
True.
Like, you know,
well,
look at the bright side here, you know.
And by the way, completely possible.
I know.
Completely possible.
And the same squeal.
Yes. Yeah. Very much so. Yeah. Urgent. But
I just hang out with the fun. I just hang out by the funnel cake stand.
Oh, that's
and
great.
And I just kind of look around with powdered sugar all over my mouth and clothes and.
Yeah. There's a right behind the funnel booth stand is where they have the where all of the recruitment goes for Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, National Guard, Coast Guard, mm-hmm. et cetera. And they have some different things over there. And one of them is this boxing thing where you go and it has the tether ball that comes mm-hmm. on and then you hit it and then it'll tell you how it go. So right behind the funnel cake booth, there is a table there. And my wife and I sit there and we call it testosterone theater. And we just sit and watch. These people try to impress their significant others as they battle the tether ball. It's endlessly entertaining. Good morning, everyone. Welcome. We hope you are having a better morning than John Bolton. We will get to that story in just a moment. We will also tell you a couple of things that we're having a big broadcast with our friends at North Country Public Radio. That's happening in Lake Placid, and this is on September 8th, we will be in Lake Placid, and we are thrilled. We're really, really happy about doing this, and so our show for this one morning will be heard both here on our radio network as well as the North Country Public Radio Network.
Wild.
And we will be simulcasting. In all my years here, I don't think we've done anything even close to this. this, and it's really cool. We have good public radio friends, and we're making the best of those friendships, and we want to talk about what's going on in the border. We want to talk what's going on about tariffs. We want to talk about the Adirondack Park. We want to talk about the changing demographics of the Adirondack Park. So we'll be doing that, and you can join us. All you have to do is go to WAMC.org and go to either the On the Road page or the Roundtable page, and you can find out information about how you can join us. But we'd love to have you. Either join us in person or join us by listening on September 8th. So I wanted to make mention of that. Also, let me impress you with this incredible group of individuals that we have before us this morning, and just great people to talk about what is happening in the world. We go to former EPA regional administrator, professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics, and author of a forthcoming book entitled
The Problem with Plastics.
The Problem with Plastics.
It'll be out in December.
And it just got my copy. I'm very excited to dig in. And congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We welcome Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Henler. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, Joe.
How are you?
I'm good, although, you know, I was thinking, like, the summer just disappeared.
Yeah.
And, like, everyone I've talked to this year, yeah, I thought it was just as you get older, time flies, but I've talked to 20-year-olds. It's like somehow this summer has been different than most summers.
I agree. I think it's because it's the end of the summer and the end of democracy at the same time.
Yeah,
well, it's the end of summer. It's the end of the world.
And previously, it was the beginning of the summer and the end of democracy going on at the time. So a lot of the summer was spent. But even my non-political friends, such as they are,
I understand.
You know, people who I'm just chatting with, you know, like our entire faculty is like, wait a minute. You know, like we usually get a break between the end of one term and the beginning of the next, and this year it feels like it was 2 weeks. And you know, one of my colleagues just said to me yesterday, you know, like it feels like mid-June in terms of, you know,
I also think that the weather had a lot to do with it, because it just rained up until like July, and then every weekend was rainy, and it just seemed sort of truncated. I did have a friend come up to me with great concern, and somebody I've known forever, and they said to me, you know, my wife and I are concerned. We've been listening to you and we're talking to you, and you just seem down. Mm-hmm. And is everything okay? You just seem down. You don't seem as happy as you usually are. And I said, well, I don't know. I said, I think I'm fine, but I don't know. Have you read a paper? Like, I don't know. I would love to feel better and a little happier about what was going on, but I don't know. I think that is it's a little bit of a wet blanket. And I just, you know, I know this because when I go to call my brothers, we are all like-minded, and, you know, we just end up just, you know, screaming.
I think my next book is going to be on radical compartmentalization. It'll be short. We have to learn that skill.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. Aaron Pasidi is with us, Siena University professor of economics. And yeah, you heard me say it, Siena University. Congratulations.
Thank you. That's a big move forward for the college.
Yeah,
and
that's really
reflects,
cool.
Where we're heading and what we've become over the last 10 years. So we'll still have our liberal arts focus, and that'll be a big part of what we do. But, you know, expanding graduate programs and so on. I'm not doing an announcement or anything to promote the college, but yeah, that's a big change, and you'll be hearing Siena University a lot more in the future.
Well, good, because maybe then it'll go through my brain cells. When you wrote us a note reminding us that it was Siena University, and that's how we should now mention it going forward, and I thought to myself, you know, my father graduated from Siena in 1949, and in my entire life it's been Siena College. So it's going to be a while before I get that right. But
I think you won't be alone.
So if I screw up, it's not intentional.
I understand. Is you it? Got it right this time. I was actually holding my breath. I'm like, what's he going to say? Am I going to have to correct him?
No.
But,
no.
Congratulations.
Siena University.
SU.
SU. Yeah. SU. Well, good morning, all. Welcome. Let's get to the news and talk about what's happening on this Friday morning as we go into the weekend. And, you know, we talk about being happy and all of that stuff. But, boy, if you could just enjoy the nature and what is out there and the beautifulness of yes. things, it's hopefully you can do that this weekend. All right. So here we go. The FBI is searching the Maryland home of ex-Trump advisor John Bolton. You remember John Bolton. FBI agents were searching his home. President Trump's former national security advisor, who is now a frequent critic of the president. In fact, I saw him on CNN just 2 days ago talking about maybe 3 days ago when Zelensky was the day after Zelensky was in town. And I thought, well, this, you know, obviously he was very outspoken that day, as he has been. And then I'm not saying that one is connected to the other, but my point being that he has continued to be an outspoken critic and is now going to dealing with them going through his home in the FBI. The details are limited as far as what they are looking for, but it believes the those who have spoken say that it is focused on whether Bolton illegally possessed or shared classified information. Right?
The irony. Right? I mean,
the book's only been out for what? How many years?
I mean,
stored in his bathroom. With yes. A lot of gold.
Yeah. So he's this is all taking place in Bethesda, Maryland. And so we look at this. I have to say that on my bingo card of people that the president may go after for retaliation, John Bolton was not on it. I just thought he was sort of out of that fray. However, obviously not the case with the investigation into his activities. And Jim, what do you make of it?
What do I make of it? Well, you know, I mean, I would never, ever accuse the current administration of hypocrisy of any kind. And, you know, we all know that President Trump would never have ever taken any kind of classified information and handled it inappropriately and showed it to the Russians and revealed, you know, national security plans to people who, you know, I would be thrown in prison forever if I did. But, you know, yeah, so clearly, apparently, Bolton's 2020 book, which has only been out for 5 years, may have had some things in it that, quote, were not properly vetted, although they were vetted. And, gee, maybe he has something in his house that he shouldn't have, unlike, you know, anyone else. So it's just, you know, when it was being done against a former president who will remain nameless, that former president defined it as a witch hunt, did everything possible to delay, and made sure that it went into the jurisdiction of somebody who happened to have been appointed by that former president. And now it's like, oh, no. No, I never did anything wrong. And look, Bolton might have told a secret. I mean, it's just the transparency of the excuses, right?
Because there have been other excuses in the past. I mean, there was the Trump administration's attempt to delay publication. There was his having his security clearance revoked as, I mean, what, within the first month?
Yes.
Of the terms. So this isn't the first attempt to go after Bolton.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, well, when the first two didn't accomplish the desired outcome, now we bring in the sledgehammer. And I think what this shows is, in a larger picture, what I call the mafia theory of the state, where the government is run like organized crime, and it governs by intimidation, it governs by fear, and for those that are not loyal or willing to just toe the party line and do what, and it, pun totally intended with this, to do what the Don says, they're going to face consequences. And the consequences are going to be, you know, they're not going to get whacked, but they're going to face extremely long court battles. They're going to be subject to having their home searched. They're going to be subject to having their family investigated. And it's really just a warning signal to anyone who dares to be critical that if you do, you're going to face consequences. So it's, you know, it's the sign of what an autocracy looks like.
This is why I half jokingly said it's the end of summer and the end of democracy, because that's certainly what this feels like. I'm not a real big fan of John Bolton or Michael Bolton. But the thing.
John or Michael.
But
no relation, but still.
And so let me be cautious for a nanosecond. We don't know what the federal magistrate based their decision on allowing for this search. But the magistrate would be defending, would be making the decision based on information provided by Kash Patel's FBI and Pam Bondi's Department of Justice. Neither of them are credible, independent public servants. In fact, Kash Patel already posted on social media this morning saying no one is above the law, which is hysterical coming from this administration. So as Aaron mentioned, Trump does not like John Bolton, mostly about his book, The Room Where It Happened. Probably sales will go up today. Now, the thing is, when you write a book about your experience in the federal government, you don't just write it and hire a publicist and issue it. It is read by multiple attorneys inside the White House at Department of Justice. They signed off on what was in this book. And in January, when he first took office, not only did Trump remove national security clearance for Bolton, but he also took away his protective detail. And the reason why he has a protective detail, you recall in the first term, he and Trump were very engaged in Iran, and Bolton has constant death threats against him. He's right. Hired his own security firm. So I just think, yeah, the details are really important. Who knows what Bolton may or may not have in his house. But if it's about the book, it was already vetted. I think we would be naive to think that this wasn't about Trump getting back at him and what I call the show. OK, the Trump show is what this is all about. And ratings are low in late August.
OK, so to keep our ratings up, we're going to at that very tense moment, we'll take a break and be right back. Good morning. We welcome you back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Judith Eng, Jim Hendler, Aaron Vasitti, and a good conversation going on the items in the news for today, which includes the FBI searching the home of former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton. Now, this happened shortly after 7 a.m. this morning, and FBI agents swarmed the house of Bolton. The house is in Bethesda, Maryland. As Judith mentioned, sort of go back, and I'll throw this back to her because I had to
rudely interrupt.
Exactly, rudely interrupt to go to business. But the investigations that makes him the latest of Trump's political enemies to find himself targeted by Justice Department probe. In recent months, federal investigators have launched criminal investigations into Trump critics, including New York Attorney General Letitia James, Senator Adam Schiff, and former FBI Director James Comey, and, as the Washington Post puts it, and many others.
Yeah, I mean, this is why this is so alarming, putting John Bolton and the singer Michael Bolton aside. this is really an erosion of democracy and such an overreach of executive power. And I also think it's part of what I call the show. Trump is an entertainer. Ratings are down at the end of August. Plus, he wants to distract from the Epstein files, which, by the way, today, Department of Justice is finally delivering, I think, some of the files to the Congressional Investigative Committee.
With names redacted.
Right. So. To protect the innocent.
Or the guilty.
Exactly. So, I was thinking recently, as Trump tries to deflect from the Epstein files, we're going to see more and more dramatic actions by him. And that's what we're seeing. Last night, he went out. He said he was going to patrol the streets of militarized Washington, D.C. No, he was behind a fence at a secure facility handing out cold pizza to these poor National Guard folks patrolling in the heat of Washington, D.C., who knows what they're doing, but nothing particularly productive. So I think the closer that people get to revealing what's in the Epstein files, we're going to see even a greater escalation of events. Now, I think, John Bolton is not on Trump's holiday card list. They're not friends. But I also think Bolton has been correctly very critical of Putin in Ukraine. And that's a sore spot for Trump. And I think that's also a big motivating factor here. And it's just a terrible day for our democracy.
Bolton's very hawkish on foreign policy.
Yes, at least.
So, I'm wondering, I've said this before, there's probably a lot of very mainstream Republicans who agree with Bolton, but they do so privately. And because they know what they have to do to, maintain the good graces of
dear leader.
Of dear leader. So it's not like Bolton's a saint. I think in any, Bolton was in the Bush administration, we'd be coming down on him so hard about his views towards what we should be doing in Iraq and the Middle East more broadly. But in this case, I find myself scratching my head because in this topsy-turvy world where up is down and black is white, I find myself coming to sympathize with people that under normal circumstances I would be 100% opposed. I'm not a foreign policy expert. I don't know where Bolton stands, but I can tell you it's probably not where the mainstream Democrats stand. So it's the same thing with Jerome Powell and the Fed. I mean, Jerome Powell is a Trump appointee. He is not a radical leftist Marxist economist leading the Fed. He's a pretty conservative economist who's fairly anti-regulation and supervision when it comes to the financial industry. But here I am coming to his rescue. I'm reading Wall Street Journal editorials, finding myself saying, well, I think they're right. So when you find yourself agreeing with people that you would normally be opposed to, it's a sign that, the world's just got shaken and normal or political, economic, and social orders are starting to rupture.
I'm going to say something probably fairly obvious, but I just wanted to illustrate, I think, the point that we try to make and often make on this program again and again. But every night before, usually between 9 and 10 o'clock, I put together a docket of stories that I send out to our panelists. And they're suggestions and nothing more. They're just ideas. And the panelists often help me. They send me ideas and we go through. And at that moment, before I go to bed, these are the ideas that we have for the morning show. Doesn't mean we'll get to all of them. May not get to any of them. But that's the idea, so we're all on the same page and have some reference point. But to your point, here were the four stories that I had on the docket. Judge orders alligator Alcatraz to be dismantled. Newsom signing the California redistricting plan. The Fed and the taking on the Fed by the Trump administration, And then in one of the odder stories that I do hope we get to about the Trump administration having a stake in Intel. So, yeah. And then you this comes up and we end up talking about that for however many minutes, which I think you have to. And I do think it's important for all the very good points that you made. But it does push all that other stuff off to the side, at least momentarily.
Yep. That's the point. I mean, when you look at that at a macro level, the point is,
it works.
Yeah, right. It does. Yeah.
Yeah. It works.
Well, and you know, I was just listening to Judith and you know, I am not exactly a literary scholar or anything like that, but, you know, I could not help thinking about Yeats's poem, The Second Coming, which has the line, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Because that's what I think this is really all about, is that you're seeing, you know, the Trump administration is becoming this centrifugal force that's pushing the left wing further left and the right wing further right. And literally this whole thing in the middle, which is where, you know, I would have put myself as middle left once upon a time. Now I'm a radical, right?
Welcome to the tribe.
But on the Democratic, but in the Democratic Party, I'm still seen as an old traditional, you know, and you're like, but
which is why Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries can't navigate our current political environment. Yeah. And I think the lesson is you just kind of need to know what your bottom line is. And I think for many, it's you should not weaponize the federal government.
But serious question just for what you said, and maybe a slight tangent, probably is. But Jeffries and Schumer, it is... There are people out there who probably could navigate that.
Yes, of course. But I think, two guys.
Right. Well, that's the point. I mean, that's what I'm thinking. It's not like it's beyond anybody. It just seems to be what the strategy that has been employed by these two Democratic leaders does not seem to be of what is needed at the moment.
They are not nimble. They are not quick. They're not reading the room. For instance, all politics is local. Zoran Mamdani won the Democratic nomination for mayor in New York City. Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries, Gillibrand, Governor Hochul, none of them have endorsed what the voters selected as their nominee. Similar stuff going on around the country. And you know, it's really unfortunate. The Times had a piece earlier this week how the Democratic Party is falling behind on voter registrations, on fundraising. If you want a two-party system, you have to have a viable second party. Elon Musk says he's not going to form a third party. Lots of independents out there. But I don't think the Democrats are meeting the moment, and that's why you know, Gavin Newsom is so high profile. I mean, I enjoy his social media and memes just like the next political junkie, but it's like so kind of weird and basic, and that's all you got from the Democrats.
You know, I listened to a lot of this, and I got to tell you, I'm puzzled because, well, I agree. I don't know what the alternative is. Okay, so for example, I keep listening now to people talking about how nothing was achieved by the Biden administration. And I'm sitting there going, remember the American Recovery Act? Remember the infrastructure bill? I mean, it's like that's ancient history. It was 3 years ago, right? I mean, this whole thing has just come in so fast, so sledgehammer.
But that proves the point that Judith is making, is that it's not what you do, it's how it's presented theatrically. Because this is political theater, right?
Well,
right?
But at the same time,
an awful reality TV show, take your pick.
Yeah, but at the same time, see, my worry is if you saw the Democrats, particularly in the Senate, becoming a lot more active, right, I am not convinced that this Senate wouldn't remove the filibuster rule. And I think Schumer is doing everything he can to make sure that that stays in place.
But is he doing that by shutting up?
Well, I have a feeling that by doing traditional backroom politics and not being out there in front yelling and screaming, you haven't heard the president getting up and saying, let's get rid of the filibuster.
Yeah, but so much other bad things are happening.
Oh, yeah. I know.
And but... I think it's, look, I kind of feel bad for Schumer because... you know, he's not a social media maven. It'd actually be better for him not to be on social media. But look at his colleague, Bernie Sanders. He's going all over the country.
Right.
Thousands of people coming out to hear his message. I mean, there are two issues. One is, how do you communicate in this world of fast-moving social media? Right. More importantly is the Democrats have to stand for something. They have to talk about... single-payer health care. They have to talk about stopping the climate crisis. I mean, that is so clear distinction between Republicans and Democrats. They have to talk about funding public education and not funneling so much to unaccountable private schools. I mean, take your issue. There are like 25 of them. But where do the Democrats stand? And I just think it's, you know, of course, they're a million times better than the Republicans, but they don't seem up to the task.
There's a Daily Show moment where Jon Stewart was reading this whole list and he said, and then how do the Democrats react? And Chuck Schumer comes on and said, I have written a strongly worded letter that I am sending to the president.
More
may be needed.
You know, I understand all that. But at the same time, you know, Judith, I think you just said it right. There's like these 25 issues, right?
Well, let's go.
If you go after these, if you go after these two, the other 23 are ignored. If you try to go after 25, that's what they're doing.
I think people can walk and chew gum at the same time.
I think it's walk, chew gum, tie your shoes, take off your hat.
I mean, the Democrats should take a lesson from what Republicans have been doing for the past 30 years. You know, gobs, guns, and taxes, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. Like, you have three core issues.
Pick a few.
And of course, there's so much more to be done, whether it's... single-payer health care, living wage, public education, climate change. Unfortunately, like, those are meat and potato issues to a lot of voters, right? Because they affect their pocketbook, they affect their day-to-day living. Talking about the threat to democracy and how, you know, Trump's out of control. Yeah, we all know this. Those are not going to mobilize voters. So, of course... Democratic voter registration's anemic. Of course, turnout for Democrats in, you know, both presidential and midterm elections is weak. They're not inspiring. Like, the last time there was any inspiring Democrat was Bernie Sanders in 2016. Yeah. Biden accomplished a lot. His campaign wasn't particularly inspiring.
But the thing, and I agree, well, with two of you anyway, that it just seems... That the thing that's missing is any sense of outrage or anger. We should be doing this and we can, and we're on the road. And it was, where, and then you, and then you turn on Bernie and he's just like, ah! And it just seems that that is. Let me just say, and this is a, and I'm sure you've all felt this way. And this is a very small sample size. But when people from our audience come up to me, they're not saying, oh, well, we ought to send the White House a letter. They're going out of their minds and wondering what they can do. And there is anger and frustration. And I do not understand why leadership cannot tap into that and find a cohesive voice to be able to spread that, because I think a lot of people are just waiting for it.
And so, I think a big reason is because who's funding the Democratic Party? They take a lot of special interest money, not as much as Republicans, but... You know, you've got these Democratic operatives, the consultants that get paid a ton of money in Washington, and the Democrats are funded by the tech bros, by
finance,
by cryptocurrency people, by polluters. And I think there's this incredible disconnect between who's funding the party, who's running the party, and then what average enrolled Democrats would like to see from their leadership.
Well, and
to give you an idea, Jim Hendler is my tech bro.
He's our tech bro.
Are some good tech bros.
I actually am insulted by being called a tech bro.
All right.
And actually, what I mean by that, Joe, is actually serious in the following sense, right? I think that my generation of the people who created this stuff have all moved to it's all about money. Right. Yeah. And I actually am someone who felt and still feels and still devotes his life to the fact that this technology is important stuff and we have to be using it appropriately and that it's not all about money. So, you know, I've turned down positions that would have made me, I hate to say it, but a multimillionaire.
And a bigger funder to WAMC.
And a bigger, well, no, because if I was
that's
in that position,
right.
It wouldn't be WAMC I was funding. It would be, you know, putting ads on whatever the big thing is or selling, making sure that I'm keeping the people who are doing the advertising on social media happy. So in other words, the tech bros have moved to deregulation is our friend. Mm-hmm. From 10 years ago where they were saying, look, we'd like very clear regulation because the current rules just sort of say we're on our own and tough.
We're extremely late for a break. We'll go. We'll take that. We'll come back. We'll go to some letters, and then we'll go to the top of the hour, and we'll move on to all of those other stories that I promised earlier on. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 22nd of August. As I mentioned, a lot of letters on the subject of Bolton and as well as just the general tenor of our conversation. We got this from David. Just remember, Trump's longtime motto has been rules for thee, not for me. We go to Anne. I choked on my coffee when I read that Kash Patel stated regarding raiding Bolton, no one is above the law. Seriously? Does he know who he works for? Democracy is dead, but irony and hypocrisy are alive and well.
And more entertaining.
And then we go to, it's the ratings. Catherine says, hello, panel. The search of John Bolton's home is another distraction from the Epstein files that have just landed in the Congress. Have a ball discussing it. Well, I don't know if it's a ball, but we'll do what we need to do here, right? Then there is a letter that, for whatever reason, is not populating in my screen. So I will say that it is a message that... that it's probably happening for a reason. John said, I'm retired and on Social Security and have been contributing financially to the Democrats' fight for our democracy for years. And what have I gotten in return? I've gotten a never-ending stream of texts and emails asking for my opinion in the form of another poll. But it's really just a trick to ask for more money because they will even record my response. So what is the use of these polls if they only take into account people who have to pay to be counted? I find this tactic incredibly off-putting. Oh, John, I feel you. It's a lot. It's a lot. I mean, obviously, it's universal. It's all sides.
It's just fundraising.
Yeah, well,
I never fill them out.
Well, spam. You know, but you know, this is in fact one of the things that I think is causing. So some of the lack of funding, right, is I must have gotten yesterday or any given day 30 to 50 messages asking me for money, all of which I'd like to give. And I can't afford to give them all a lot of money. And I don't want to give them a little money because then I get on yet more lists and I get more things. And, you know, as a result, you end up with the people who are giving the $3 and the $5 and the $20 donations now being not having a single central entity that's collecting that money. And the Dems are trying to do that. They've been pulling more together. But that's been, to me, that's an issue. And you know, I get something from hi, I'm so-and-so. I'm running in, you know, Alabama's 13th district.
Right.
And I'm, you know, the mother of four, and I'm on your side democratically and things like that. I love this person, but, you know, $3.
It's also, and I take John's point in that I've been contributing financially to the Democrats for years, and they say they're going to fight, but what have I gotten in return? And I think that's a really good point, because what they've gotten, yes, it's fundraising, it's asking for information so you can be on other lists, so you can help candidates in Alabama and elsewhere. And that's, but that gets, doesn't that get back to, and I realize this is more complex, but that if there was a message, if there was a cohesive message, if there was someone at the top of the food chain who is actually dealing out what we're going to talk about this week, that could actually, that John could feel not disenfranchised, but that the money that he's putting in is actually doing something and helping this quote-unquote fight.
But do let me remind John, having just made my own comment about funding, that, you know, thanks to the Democrats, there's the Affordable Care Act, a lot of the Medicaid and Medicare, the attempts to cut those things were kept under control.
But what have you done for me lately?
And that's where the problem comes in, is, you know, sort of...
Special interest groups get that message all the time, you know? And now it's just
as... the problem. We don't know what the special interest groups are.
Well, we know now, because Trump's charging crypto dudes, you know, $1 million to come have dinner with him or whatever it is. And the next day he's talking about, well, we're going to... Yeah, we're going to develop a national crypto reserve. And it's like...
We've said bros and dudes on this show more than I think we ever have.
You started out talking about testosterone, so I think that just set the...
But here's
the thing. Okay, so opposing crypto, would that be a Democratic winner? Most people don't understand.
Exactly, it's a non-issue. But getting back to these meat and potato issues, it's like, okay, here's someone on Social Security.
We have to find what those issues are.
There's no shortage of issues. Social Security, access to health care, the environment. And these are issues that you can speak to people's self-interest. Everyone's utility bills are going way, way up because Trump is promoting coal and killing solar and wind, which is now cheaper than fossil fuels. It's not a hard set of facts to communicate. It just seems like the Democratic Party is not meeting the moment.
Right.
Pick any three. I don't care. Just pick three and have a strategy.
Have some focus groups. Do some research about what's important to voters swing
they're
voters.
Doing that in the primary
and seem like you care and be angry and frustrated.
That I think.
Right.
Yeah. Have some empathy.
Yeah. And, you know, empathy. Oh, God, empathy.
And it's a whole new political environment because you have elected Republicans who are just there to bend the knee. So. Mm-hmm. The Democrats just need to really figure out and articulate a strategy. And like, none of this is super surprising in terms of where we are with Trump. I will admit, I did not anticipate the wrecking ball of Elon Musk, but I really thought the courts would do more, and the lower courts are, but there's the accelerated docket when it gets to the Supreme Court. They are dreadful. But, you know, come on, go to like a 3-day retreat in the Adirondacks and figure it out.
We will accelerate our docket right after this newscast from Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 22nd of August. You name enough days, you're going to hit it eventually.
I told you the time is just flying by fast.
It really is. Friday, the 22nd of August. It is 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. Judith Henk is here, former EPA regional administrator, professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics. Jim Henler joins us, tetherless world professor of computer, web, and cognitive sciences at RPI, and Siena University professor of economics, Aaron Pasitti. We welcome you all. panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We did get a lot of letters on what we were talking about in regards to the Democrats and what they should do and so forth. And we're going to move on to some other topics. And I promise if we get time at the end, I will go back to those letters and we can get to them and address them. But I do want to get to... we haven't even gotten to the stories that we actually planned on talking about. So we'll do that. All right. Here we go. The big story yesterday before I went to bed was that Florida ordered to dismantle alligator Alcatraz over the environmental impact. The ruling, which gives the state 60 days to act, comes as Governor Ron DeSantis plans to convert a prison in North Florida into a second immigrant detention site. A federal judge in Miami gave the state of Florida just 60 days to clear out the immigrant detention facility, which is called Alligator Alcatraz, handing environmentalists and Indian tribe?
Yeah, Miskokie Indian tribe.
Of a win after they clashed with Governor Ron DeSantis over the environmental impacts the makeshift site was having on the federally protected Everglades. The ruling late Thursday from U.S. District Judge Kathleen Williams, which forbids state officials from moving any other migrants there, deals a blow to what had become a marquee symbol of President Donald Trump's immigration policy. Judith, I know you have a lot to say on this, and here's just my question, which is, as I read this story, and I remember thinking, I thought this from the very beginning of when it was announced, but how could this happen in the Everglades? Like, how could that not be set up for major issues when you're doing this in the Everglades?
Yeah, I was expecting a lawsuit and a victory like this because it's right in the middle of the Everglades. And in fact, the judge in her 82-page ruling quoted President Harry Truman when he dedicated the Everglades National Park in 1947. He called the Everglades an irreplaceable primitive area. And the basis of the judge's decision was very important. Two points. One is the government did not comply with the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. NEPA is the law that says, particularly when federal funds are involved, you just need to take a hard look and look at the environmental impacts before you build. Certainly, Trump and DeSantis did not want their show delayed, so they didn't do the environmental review. The second part of this decision, which has not gotten much attention, but I think is quite important, is this lawsuit was brought by the Miskosukee tribe in Florida. This is a federally recognized Indian nation. And until the Trump administration, the federal government took the consultation process with Indian nations very seriously. One of the things I was really proud of when I served at EPA during the Obama administration is the government-to-government consultation process. And here, they were just ignored. They sued. They won. Cue some racist remarks that I'm sure will be coming from Trump later today. What the judge found in the Everglades here is that this construction project has caused irreparable harm to habitat loss and increased mortality to endangered species. It's damaging the wetlands in the Everglades, which is also a drinking water source for some local communities. And what DeSantis and Trump try to do is say that NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act, doesn't apply because while the facility houses federal immigrant detainees, it is run by the state, and therefore you don't have to comply with NEPA, which any reasonable judge would reject. So, you know, there is a whole set of issues about concerns about how people are being treated in the facility. But I think it's the environmental laws and the brave leadership of the Indian Nation and environmental groups in Florida that win the day here. Of course, this is going to be appealed, but the judge said everything needs to be taken down within 60 days.
But how often has the Trump administration listened to court rulings, right? So, I mean, that's my concern is that, yes, this is an important ruling, but, and I'm going to pose this question to you. Do you think that's actually going to happen?
Well, they will certainly slow walk it, and they will appeal. It's very hard to completely ignore a federal judge. I mean, they've done it, but they don't do it regularly. And they probably are also recognizing that there's just like real operational problems here. All of this was rushed because the Trump administration and Governor DeSantis wanted to call something alligator Alcatraz. Remember, Trump wanted to reopen Alcatraz in San Francisco.
Right.
This is the show. It's all the show. It's not real. These people cannot govern.
Yeah.
I'm not putting the environmental impact aside at all. Then there just is the running of the facility.
That's the bigger issue.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and what is happening to these people and how they're being treated and what is, in my mind, clearly very disturbing as to how those who are housed there are being treated.
Congressmember Frost from Florida, the youngest member of the House, actually got in to tour the facility, and he was really concerned about the conditions that he saw. People, you know, crowded in cages without access. The drinking water and the toilet are right next to each other. Inadequate food, he said, with maggots in the food. And what I thought was really striking by comments by Congressmember Frost is he said, everyone that was being jailed looked like him, young men of color, and he was the only one who got to walk out.
I think, you know, this goes back to the mafia theory of the state, which is governing by intimidation. So we were talking about Bolton and how that is designed to intimidate people in policy circles to toe the line. I think there's a larger issue with alligator Alcatraz in that it's intimidating immigrants and people of color. And, you know, I mean, that's been a cornerstone of the Trump platform since he made his first speech after descending the escalator in Trump Tower. But he's, and I know a lot of his base supports this, and you can make very sensible arguments that we should have some type of broader immigration reform. There was something that was proposed in, I forget when it was, but the, you know, the bipartisan
Congress,
bill.
Yeah, Senator Linford, that Trump killed.
I think what's going to happen is, you know, I mean, people are ignoring the economics of this. And immigrants are a source of labor supply for the economy, particularly in an economy when you're seeing falling labor force participation rates of native-born people, particularly men. You're starting to see the demographic headwinds of increasing retirement of boomers and then falling fertility rates amongst younger generations. So there's a labor supply issue in the country, and immigrants have helped, particularly during COVID, when there was that surge in immigration, offset some of that decrease in labor supply. Immigration, I mean, economists universally agree that immigration is a small net benefit for the economy as a whole. Immigrants create businesses. Immigrants create jobs. They're job creators, too, just like Mitt Romney and his, you know, hedge fund or consulting firm. But there are sectoral impacts that I think are going to hit consumers. I mean, if this continues with the, you know, the mask ICE raids and the alligator Alcatraz and whatever comes next, the big sectors in which foreign-born workers are employed in disproportionately large quantities are agriculture, construction, and food processing.
Yep.
So housing prices and food prices are going to be affected. And this is what people were up in arms about during the Biden administration. And that was a temporary phenomenon where it was, you know, COVID-related supply chains, every economy was out of whack. this is going to put upward pressure on food prices. We're already starting to see the increase in prices of fresh fruits and vegetables.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, if you thought COVID inflation was bad going to the grocery store, give yourself a couple months and then re-examine that. Housing prices are going to go up because, again, there's the construction aspect. Food processing, whether it's slaughterhouses and meat or more broad food processing plants that produce cereals, bread, and, you know, the stuff that's in the middle of the supermarket more broadly. This is going to have economic impacts that I do not think the Trump administration is aware of or even cares about if they are. But I think a lot of consumers are going to be unpleasantly surprised if this trend regarding ruling by intimidation of immigrants and foreign-born workers continues.
So I agree with you completely. And I think there's a wrinkle here that's hard for a lot of people to understand. And that's part of what makes this so tricky, right? So it kind of gets into the definition of illegality of immigrants, right? So there's really several different categories in there that are being lumped together. There are people here completely legally, right? They've become citizens. There are people here who are on their way to that, who came in through legal mechanisms. There are people who got special entry things from certain countries, that, and then there's ones who came in, quote, illegally, unquote.
And many of them are asylum seekers.
Yes, yes. Were fleeing. Well, and I'm, that I would have normally put in that second to last category, right? In other words, they were still being part of the legal process. So now the problem you have is that you get a raid on, I don't know, an agricultural facility, right? And you've got a few people in there who are in that last category, and theoretically it was only going to be the dangerous, horrible people, but it's now they've realized that there aren't just enough of those to do it. So it's everybody. But then the problem becomes, okay, so now you have the person who is in that middle category who every 2 months has to show up at a particular courthouse to prove that they are still within the rules. But now if they show up at that courthouse, they're likely right. to get grabbed. And so now they don't show up at the courthouse, which moves them into the category of someone who's here, quote, illegally, unquote. Meanwhile, they still have their construction job, are paying taxes, get no benefits from the taxes once they're onto that. I mean, you know, it's a crazy situation. It's evolved over a lot of years. And frankly, most Americans, as far as I can tell, do not understand the difference between a, quote, illegal immigrant and a, quote, legal. You know, I don't even know. We don't even have a single word for someone who is here pending legal approval.
Well, I think that's a really good review of the status. But I also want to make the point that no human is illegal. And what we're seeing happening at 26 Federal Plaza in our own state is really outrageous. Where, as you mentioned, Jim, people show up for their court-mandated hearing with a judge. By the way, these immigration judges are employees of the Department of Justice. Yep. And about 50% of them are then grabbed in the hallway and torn away from their families. And then either many of them spend time in a conference room at 26 Federal Plaza. There were videotapes that were revealed showing, you know, there's no beds, there's no access to sanitation. But if they're not detained in the conference room, then they could be sent to Louisiana or Texas.
Or alligator
Sudan.
Yeah. And then eventually possibly, or you know, that horrible Supermax facility in El Salvador. Although right. I think, are they no longer sending to El Salvador? I know people are still detained there, but I don't know if they're still flying people to El Salvador.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I think deal was made between several different countries so that they, you know, government is paid. So
Aaron brought up a great point earlier, which is of we sort of know what the lawsuits are, the court rulings. We don't know whether they're being actually followed or not, which is harder to ascertain
isn't
at
that
some
amazing?
Points.
Like a year
but
ago.
Nobody's above the law. Remember that.
All right. I want to, we just have about 5 minutes before bottom of the hour break, and I don't want to shortchange this, and we can certainly continue the conversation after, but this is also breaking news that Jerome Powell, the chair of the Federal Reserve, on Friday used a closely watched speech to send his strongest signal yet that the central bank is preparing to soon restart interest rate cuts, highlighting the labor market's vulnerabilities even as inflation accelerates. Mr. Powell held back from explicitly endorsing a reduction in borrowing costs at the Fed's next meeting in September, but his emphasis on the prospects of a weakening economic backdrop made clear that a cut is likely next month. Mr. Powell said in his final speech as Fed chair at an annual conference hosted by the Reserve Bank of Kansas City in Jackson, Wyoming. I'll figure that out someday. The balance, quote, the balance of risks appears to be shifting. With borrowing costs weighing on the economy, the labor market softening, and inflation risks contained, quote, the shifting balance of risks may warrant adjusting our policy stance, said the chair. That from the New York Times. This from Aaron Pasitti.
That's not surprising at all. I think everybody was, all economists who have been paying attention, was expecting to hear something like that. Ironically, because of the downward revisions to job growth over the past 3 months that sent Trump into a fury that caused him to fire the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So the economy is slowing. The job growth is not what people thought it was. Inflation is more muted than a lot of economists thought it was going to be. So when he says that the balances are shifting, the Federal Reserve has a very narrow but very deep mandate, and it's called the dual mandate. And that is to achieve full employment, which is, you know, low unemployment, you know, 3-4%, and price stability, which is inflation around 2%. And, you know, when Trump took office, that's more or less what existed. We had full employment and price stability, and then the combination of policy uncertainty, Liberation Day, the masked ICE raids, all of these things sent the economy into flux. And Powell's line wasn't, we're not going to raise rates because I don't like you and what you're doing. Powell was saying, we need to wait and see how these things unfold. We need more time before we rush to any decisions, because when the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates, it accelerates economic growth by lowering borrow costs. It encourages banks to lend more. It encourages consumers to borrow more. And it leads to an upturn in economic activity that creates jobs, that puts downward pressure on unemployment. But the cost of that is higher inflation. You start heating the economy up. Businesses have more pricing power. Workers have more room to negotiate wage increases. So you get rising inflation. When the Fed raises interest rates, the opposite happens. It raises borrowing costs. It cools demand for loans. And it causes job growth to slow. So we get rising unemployment, but we get lower inflation. So there's a trade-off between the full employment and price stability, meaning the unemployment and inflation trade-offs of what the Fed does. And Powell's been very cautious, saying we don't have enough evidence to justify a rate increase to fight inflation or a rate decrease to fight unemployment. We need to wait and see. And when last month's job report came out, it became very clear that the economy was slowing more than economists anticipated, and that inflation was a lot more muted than economists anticipated. So, of course, he's going to suggest that we consider, you know, a small decrease in rates. What Powell made very clear in that speech, even though I haven't had time to read it because it literally came out when we were sitting here talking about Alligator Alcatraz, is that Powell is putting a rate cut back on the table, not because Trump told him to, but because economic conditions have warranted such a policy change. And the independence of the central bank and keeping it apolitical, meaning free from political meddling, is what gives the U.S. economy a lot of its strength, a lot of its credibility. It makes it an end result for a lot of foreign investment and foreign savings. When you reduce that credibility by putting politicians in charge, all of a sudden you're going to end up shooting yourself in the foot because you're creating an uncertain environment, and it is going to actually stall growth.
Well, and I have a question for Aaron.
Can you hold the question?
Yes.
Okay. Don't forget it. Write it down. And even if that's insulting that I think you'll forget it, just write it down so you remember that I remember to ask you about it. We'll take a break and we'll continue. Judah Thank, Aaron Bassetti, and Jim Henler. We will come back for our final half hour. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Was that rehearsal? Is that just what that was? We were sort of going over it. In all the years we've been doing this show, I don't really recall us actually planning anything.
So you have three college professors.
Yeah, so I know. That's the problem.
The only thing we do is plan.
It's not a problem at all, but we're thrilled to have you all here. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. When last we met, we were talking about the Fed and the speech this morning by the Fed chair, Jerome Powell. And just as we were ready to go to a break, Jim said, "Hey, I have a question." And I said, "Oh, great. Hold that question and we'll go right to it when we come back." So we're back. We'll go right to it.
Okay. So it's really, you know, it gets back to the whole mafia style thing and et cetera, et cetera. So Trump will get to appoint a new Fed chair, I think in May,
when the term expires.
And, you know, one would assume, based on current performance, that that will not be somebody who is being picked for their economic knowledge, but for their...
They'll be Matt Gaetz.
Their loyalty. Well, and so my question to Aaron is really, how will that impact all of this kind of...
Sure.
We keep talking about how it's so important they're not politicized, but they're going to become politicized one way or the other. Come May.
So excellent question. And this is the $30 trillion question that a lot of economists are debating, is that what happens when you have a legitimate loyalists? I mean, presidents in the past have twisted arms of Fed chairs to get, more favorable monetary policy. But installing a pure loyalist is a very different story. Now, I'm sorry to get wonky and go into detail here, but when the Federal Reserve meets every 6 weeks to determine the course of monetary policy and their interest rate decisions, it's the Federal Open Market Committee, which consists of 12 people within the Fed, the seven governors, four district bank presidents, and a New York Fed president. So installing one of 12 as a loyalist doesn't guarantee the FOMC, the voting body of the Fed who determines interest rate cuts, is going to produce the outcome the president wants. So you would really have to stack the deck within the FOMC by not only installing the chair who can steer the discussion and kind of persuade other governors to do it. And you're already seeing this with Lisa Cook, where they're drumming up, she may have possibly committed mortgage fraud, so she should just resign anyway and just get this out before it becomes a scandal.
Tell us about it, because this happened just in the last.
Yeah, no, this happened earlier this week, where Lisa Cook, who is a member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors and a Biden appointee,
First black woman ever on the...
Yeah, right, yes, there's right, yes, a right. pattern here. Trump goes after African-American women consistently.
So, she's not a loyalist. She was somebody who has been, much like Jerome Powell and everybody else on the committee, pro-Fed independence. But, she has appeared to have falsified bank documents to obtain favorable mortgage terms. Well, that's – and, that accusation was made by I forget what the Federal Housing Finance Agency leader, who was a Trump loyalists. So, you know, Trump is just delegating. He doesn't need to formally delegate. The leaders of these groups know what they need to do to stay in his good favor. So you get out, you know, the black woman who's a Biden appointee, and that opens up one more space for a loyalist. So you start stacking the deck so that the Fed becomes far more politicized.
And I just want to point out that so-called mortgage fraud is what they're also going after Attorney General Tish James on and California Senator, California Senator...
One who led
Adam
the,
Schiff.
Schiff.
Yeah. Adam Schiff. Just a moment. So
proving we really are all professors. We all sat there.
So I mean, the pattern here is they seem to.
If you don't preface it by shifty Schiff, I'm lost. Yeah,
I know. Mortgage fraud seems to be the flavor of the day, going after political enemies.
It's, anybody who's applied for a mortgage knows that there's an enormous amount of documentation you need to provide. So. It's something you start investigating somebody's finances. Mm-hmm. It opens up the book. So if you don't find the mortgage fraud, you might find something else. The last thing I want to say about the Fed and Jim's question about what happens when an institution that is designed to be independent from political pressure becomes politicized. We've got two 21st real world examples of that. The first one is Turkey. When Erdogan installed, Erdogan wanted the Turkish Central Bank to cut interest rates to stimulate the economy, to give him a boost so that he had more popular support. So inflation in Turkey between 2005 and 2015 averaged 5 to 10%, fairly stable. Once he installed his loyalists at the central bank, inflation in Turkey is now 60%. So,
wow.
There's another one. Wait, it gets better. And I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name right. Orban in Hungary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that how it's said?
Yeah.
He did the same thing. Hungary had 5%, pretty stable 5% inflation from 2000. Orban takes power. He starts consolidating power, including at the central bank. And what happens is inflation increases from 5% to 17%. So you're seeing tripling of inflation rates in the two examples that have happened within the last 5 years. So if Trump gets his way, we should all be prepared for a much higher inflation, much less stable economy that will ultimately be Trump's undoing if it happens, unless he holds on to power through more militaristic means.
Or because that still will benefit the high end more than the low end.
Yeah, right. It'll be lower and middle income groups who suffer. Billionaires can handle, changes in inflation and 20% unemployment.
Because they're paying cash. Yeah. But remember how dominant the price of eggs were in the last campaign.
Yeah. All right. We have some time here. I want to also go to a story that I've actually been meaning to get to for a couple of days, and other stuff going on, and it made it difficult to do that. But the question here is. And what we're talking about is the Trump administration is discussing taking a 10% stake in Intel. The Trump administration had discussed taking this stake in Intel as part of this government-backed program. This is one of those things I didn't know you could do.
In capitalism, you mean?
Yeah, I just... Okay, so how does that work, and what does that mean, and what precedent does that send? And I realize that this is a tech story, and this is a economic story, so I will throw it to both of you.
Our tech bro.
Yes.
Right.
Our tech and finance bro.
So actually that works great, because I'll say a few words about the tech part, but then really want to throw it over to Aaron, because I have a very specific question about the other part.
Okay.
So the tech part is the U.S. microchip providers have been in trouble for a while now. Or calling them in trouble is not even the right thing. The big producers offshored a lot of that because it was much cheaper to buy these things from Taiwan, which was developing the technology. The international ownership of these things is very complex. If you look at global foundries, there's a reason why that first word is global. But there's a set of chip makers who compete with each other, right? Intel is one of them, right? Intel's run into trouble largely because the competition has been doing a better job as, so in capitalist terms, they haven't done as well, right? A lot of what caused them the problem was NVIDIA, which is also a U.S. company, okay? Now what's happening is the government is saying, okay, we will bail you out, but we will own a piece of you. And that, to me, is part of the, you know, sounds like it's part of the authoritarian playbook, right? Which is to, the U.S. has always pushed to privatize. And here's a case of essentially, quote, nationalizing, or at least partially mm-hmm. nationalizing, a company, and owning that stake would mean if, say, there's some bid for some government project between Intel and others, I have trouble believing that this government would recuse itself. But that said, when I read about the, you know, I went back and reviewed the stuff on the auto bailout under Obama, it does mention certain things having to do with stock and equity. So I really wanted to ask Aaron, you know, I know from what I've read that this is different, but could you... So just do a quick.
Sure.
Do your thing.
My understanding is that when the financial crisis in September of 2008 happened, that reverberated throughout the entire economy. And, you know, one of the country's major employers in the auto sector. So when President Obama took office, there were the auto bailouts, as they're called, meaning the federal government gave money to Chrysler and General Motors to maintain payroll, to be able to keep paying rent, to keep the electricity on, to keep, you know, being able to buy parts from vendors. The goal is to keep the pipeline of capital and money open so that these firms didn't go bankrupt and create a second Great Depression. Well, when the federal government bailed out these firms, they took stock and corporate bonds as essentially collateral for those grants, so that when Chrysler and General Motors were able to pay those grants back, that the federal government relinquished its shares of the stock and bonds that they held. So that's just using stock and bonds as collateral. What's happening with Intel is that the government is taking an equity stake, meaning now they own 10%. They have a 10% share. They have a 10% ownership share in Intel. And if you own stock, that also means you have voting rights in terms of what the company invests in. You can exert your influence to have them do A or do B or do C. And this is just part of the imperial presidency.
Sounds like socialism to me.
It's yeah. I mean, it's when the government starts, exactly. It's,
yeah.
I mean, this is what China and a lot of other countries do. And here, the weird thing about this is that, you know, the federal government gave Intel an $11 billion grant. They want that to be converted to stock. But it's not clear whether that grant is actually going to solve Intel's problems, as Jim was alluding to. There's structural problems. There's a lot more competition. The dynamics of what chips are being produced and what chips are in demand is changing so rapidly, particularly over the last 3 to 4 years, that the federal government just giving Intel this and then taking an equity stake, I don't think is going to solve Intel's problems. Trump just wants his administration to make it seem like he's making a deal, and that's the goal. And the way, you know, it's like,
show.
We're giving you this, you give me that. Right. It's a tit for tat.
And it's not the first time. I can't remember the name of the company, but a few weeks ago, Trump reached an agreement with a major company, and they had to agree to give like 10 or 15% of their profits to the federal government.
So it's that the two largest chip makers now or providers, it's a complex thing, were NVIDIA and AMD, and what the deal Trump made with them is that he would reduce the tariffs to China. So they were not being allowed to sell to China. They need to sell to China to be profitable. Trump made a deal with them that he'd reduce essentially the amount of tariff to where they could still make money, but they had to give the U.S. government a piece of
payment.
That.
Direct payment. And then Aaron identified U.S. Steel.
Yeah.
And now federal interest there. My goodness, this sounds like creeping socialism.
Yeah.
What are the Republicans
going to do? Nothing.
Well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a quick break, and we can wrap all of this up in a nice, tidy little bow when we return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Jim Henler, Aaron Pacitti, and Judith Ink. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Last call for the letters this morning. Anybody, anything else that you wanted to mention before we go to the stuff here, some of the letters that we got on this? Kathy says, Intel is a loser. I had held it for many years and recently sold it for the best price I could because the asking price is dropping. The government should stay out of the stock market. Trump's plan is ridiculous. And that from Kathy.
It's not that the government's involved in the stock market. It's that the government is now becoming involved in the day-to-day operations of private companies, which, you know, Adam Smith wrote about this in 1776, which is that, you know, capitalist markets work best when there is, you know, minimal government intervention. And there are plenty of arguments for government regulation of certain industries because they have negative effects on, say, the environment or workers' rights. There's plenty of reasons government should be involved in the economy to stabilize it, to keep it regulated. But managing the affairs of private companies is not part of the capitalist playbook.
Hmm. I.e. CBS.
Well, and you know, the arguing Tiffany from both network, sides yes. of their mouth, of course, because they're on one hand doing this, and on the other hand, for other kinds of technology, particularly AI, the president's action plan said explicitly, you know, all of these government agencies should waive all of their regulations on AI and just let, you know, the AI companies do whatever the hell they want. And in fact, it'll also override state rules because they said, by the way, we're also going to part of the plan said if somebody wants to build a data center in your state and it's with, you know, modulo XYZ, but you know, if you can, but essentially you're screwed. You can't say no. So for example, in New York State, several of those are likely to go into be created, which means the state will not be able to make its climate goals. And now, instead of being told, sorry, we're overriding your climate goals, it's, I'm sorry, you can't do that because that would be AI regulation. So one hand, they're saying, and we're very publicly anti-regulation, and we're very quietly taking over these companies and regulating them. It's more the hypocrisy.
Hey, panel, says Scott. Hey, panel, quit walking your points back to be fair. We are not in a fair fight. We are in a scrap for real. This is reality. This can come crashing down with a single variable. I am very sorry if you got the impression that we didn't think that.
Yeah. Who was walking? I'm curious as to who was walking what back.
I might have been considered being too moderate today. Just
anyway. Well, it is interesting, but I understand the point of the letter. I agree with the letter. Yeah, it's a very good point. Let's see. John Bolton is not going to be intimidated by this latest Trump folly. Let's take a step back and remember John Bolton has been in this game a generation longer than any of the clowns in this administration. There are bigger players in Washington than this president and his administration. It's an interesting point.
Yeah, and John Bolton has a lot of money. You know, he is advising major companies on national security. But the point is, what happens when they go after, like, a middle-level civil servant who can't spend $1 million on attorneys. I think it's – my bigger fear is just the erosion of democracy, John Bolton.
Member of the Fed's Board of Governors.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
Are there news crews outside the home and office of Bolton? How about the House offices to see if any trooper in D.C. has filed a complaint, as they may do? The troops are federal since the president asked for them. They are under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Well, there is a difference between Bethesda, Maryland, and the District of Columbia,
Bethesda's
the city of Washington.
The leafy suburb of D.C.
The leafy suburb of Washington, D.C., that's right. True story, Nebraska is now building what they're calling the Cornhusker Clink. I had not heard that, but I don't... But I don't like it.
Oh.
There's unlimited money in the recent federal budget to build these facilities all over the country.
Yeah. We do get letters like this from time to time, and I understand them, of course. But can we stop calling it Alligator Alcatraz? You're spreading administration propaganda by doing so. I agree, but you know it's like the Build Back Better bill. You know, if that's what it's called, I don't like it, and it may not be at all accurate, but it's what it is officially called.
But on WAMC, we can christen the word Everglades Destroyer Facility.
Well, John says it would be better termed as Alligator Auschwitz.
Yes, that is
okay.
Closer.
Well, Judith doesn't like that.
Well, it doesn't capture the environmental. So we need an A word for environmentals.
Let's see. I promised you other things here.
Alligator anti-environmental.
Oh, and this is our fault. We just didn't get to it. But Kenny says Governor Newsom signed a bill that will go to a vote in 77 days. I don't think Texas is united enough to get redistricting to a vote in time in the next election. But we should mention what's happening in California.
Yeah, I mean, Newsom is really taking this on. And unlike in New York, you could just have the legislature vote, which they did this week.
Right.
Newsom signed the bill yesterday. It goes to the voters in November. And his redistricting map is not all that different than the current map. Katie Porter, who's running for governor of California, go Katie, she said that the district is the same pretty much of her old district. It's a competitive district. Yeah. I do want to point out I'm quite concerned about what Texas is doing, but I also think Texas is probably going to lose in court because it is clearly racist in the way they drew the lines. And in previous court decisions, Texas has lost.
We will end with those words. My thanks to this magnificent panel on this Friday morning. I hope you all have a beautiful weekend. I so appreciate your camaraderie and your great insights. It's always a pleasure to work with all of you. Have a great weekend. We'll be back with more show. We have an hour left. All kinds of good stuff we can talk about. We'll do exactly that right after this short break.